Chapter 14. The First Civilizations. First, early cities and early nomads. Second, A, the Sumerians. Second, B, the Empire of Sargon the First. Second, C, the Empire of Hammurabi. Second, D, the Assyrians and their empire. Second, E, the Chaldean Empire. Third, the early history of Egypt. Fourth, the early civilization of India. Fifth, the early history of China. Sixth, while the civilizations were growing. First, it was out of the so-called Heliolithic culture we've described in Chapter 12 that the first beginnings of anything that we can call a civilization arose. It's still doubtful whether we're to consider Mesopotamia or Egypt the earlier scene of the two parallel beginnings of settled communities living in towns. By 4000 BC, in both these regions of the earth, such communities existed, and had been going on for a very considerable time. The excavations of the American expedition at Nippur have unearthed evidence of a city community existing there at least as early as 5000 BC, and probably as early as 6000 BC, an earlier date than anything we know of in Egypt. The late Mr. Aaron Aronson found a real wild wheat upon the slopes of Mount Hermon, and it must be that somewhere in that part of the world its cultivation began. It may be that from the western end of the Mediterranean, possibly in some region now submerged, as a center, that the cultivation of wheat spread over the entire eastern hemisphere. But cultivation isn't civilization. The growing of wheat had spread from the Atlantic to the Pacific coast with the distribution of the Neolithic culture by perhaps 15,000 or 10,000 BC before the beginnings of civilization. Civilization is something more than the occasional seasonal growing of wheat. It's the settlement of men upon an area continuously cultivated and possessed, who live in buildings continuously inhabited, with a common rule and a common city or citadel. For a long time, civilization may quite possibly have developed in Mesopotamia without any relations with the parallel beginnings in Egypt. The two settlements may have been quite independent, arising separately out of the widely diffused Heliolithic Neolithic culture, or they may have had a common origin in the region of the Mediterranean, the Red Sea, and southern Arabia. The first condition necessary to a real settling down of Neolithic men as distinguished from a mere temporary settlement among abundant food, was, of course, a trustworthy all-the-year-round supply of water, fodder for the animals, food for themselves, and building material for their homes. There had to be everything they could need at any season, and no want that would tempt them to wander further. This was a possible state of affairs, no doubt, in many European and Asiatic valleys, and in many such valleys, as in the case of the Swiss lake dwellings, men settled from a very early date indeed. But nowhere, in any countries now known to us, were these favourable conditions found upon such a scale, and nowhere did they hold good so surely year in and year out as in Egypt and in the country between the upper waters of the Euphrates and Tigris and the Persian Gulf. Here was a constant water supply under enduring sunlight, trustworthy harvests year by year. In Mesopotamia, wheat yielded, says Herodotus, 200-fold to the sower. Pliny says that it was cut twice and afterwards yielded good fodder for sheep. There were abundant palms and many sorts of fruits, and as for building material in Egypt, there was clay and easily worked stone, and in Mesopotamia, a clay that becomes a brick in the sunshine. In such countries, men would cease to wander and settle down almost unawares. They'd multiply and discover themselves numerous and by their numbers safe from any casual assailant. They multiplied, producing a denser human population than the earth had ever known before. Their houses became more substantial, wild beasts were exterminated over great areas, the security of life increased so that ordinary men went about in the towns and fields without encumbering themselves with weapons, and among themselves, at least, they became peaceful peoples. men took root as man had never taken root before. But in the less fertile and more seasonal lands outside these favoured areas, in the forests of Europe, the Arabian deserts, and the seasonal pastures of Central Asia, there developed, on the other hand, a thinner, more active population of peoples, the primitive nomadic peoples. In contrast with the settled folk, the agriculturalists, these nomads lived freely and dangerously. They were, in comparison, lean and hungry men. Their herding was still blended with hunting. They fought constantly for their pastures against hostile families. The discoveries of the elaboration of implements and the use of metals made by the settled peoples spread to them and improved their weapons. They followed the settled folk from Neolithic phase to Bronze phase. It's possible that in the case of iron, the first users were nomadic. They became more warlike, with better arms and more capable of rapid movements with the improvement of their transport. One mustn't think of a nomadic stage as a predecessor of a settled stage in human affairs. To begin with, man was a slow drifter following food. Then one sort of men began to settle down, and another sort became more distinctly nomadic. The settled sort began to rely more and more upon grain for food. The nomad began to make greater use of milk for food. He bred his cows for milk. The two ways of life specialized in opposite directions. It was inevitable that nomad folk and the settled folk should clash, that the nomads should seem hard barbarians to the settled peoples, and the settled peoples soft and effeminate, and very good plunder to the nomad peoples. Along the fringes of the developing civilizations, there must have been a constant raiding and bickering between hardy nomad tribes and mountain tribes and the more numerous and less warlike peoples in the towns and villages. For the most part, this was a mere raiding of the borders. The settled folk had the weight of numbers on their side. The herdsmen might raid and loot, but they couldn't stay. That sort of mutual friction might go on for many generations, but ever and again we find some leader or some tribe amidst the disorder of free and independent nomads, powerful enough to force a sort of unity upon its kindred tribes, and then woe betide the nearest civilization. Down pour the united nomads on the unwarlike, unarmed plains, and there ensues a war of conquest. Instead of carrying off the booty, the conquerors settle down on the conquered land, which becomes all booty for them. The villagers and townsmen are reduced to servitude and tribute-paying. They become hewers of wood and drawers of water, and the leaders of the nomads become kings and princes, masters and aristocrats. They too settle down. They learn many of the arts and refinements of the conquered. They cease to be lean and hungry. But for many generations they retain traces of their old nomadic habits. They hunt and indulge in open-air sports. They drive and race chariots. They regard work, especially agricultural work, as the lot of an inferior race and class. This, in a thousand variations, has been one of the main stories in history for the last 70 centuries or more. In the first history that we can clearly decipher, we find already in all the civilized regions a distinction between a non-working ruler class and the working mass of the population. And we find, too, that after some generations the aristocrat, having settled down, begins to respect the arts and refinements and law-abidingness of settlement, and to lose something of his original hardihood. He intermarries. He patches up a sort of toleration between conqueror and conquered. He exchanges religious ideas and learns the lessons upon which soil and climate insist. He becomes a part of the civilization he has captured. And, as he does so, events gather towards a fresh invasion by the free adventurers of the outer world.